You need to embrace capitalism.
It is this hope which is the lever of progress.
My favorite Fed.
To keep one's reactions warm and true.
They attack us because we're over there.
Is to have found the secret of perpetual youth.
Man, you're too pretty to be a libertarian.
And perpetual youth is salvation.
The following exchange was published in a British humor magazine, Punch, on April 3rd, 1957. It is reprinted here as an appropriate introduction as a mental exercise to limber the mind for the material contained in this book.
What are banks for?
To make money.
For the customers?
For the banks.
Why doesn't the bank advertising mention this?
It would not be in good taste. But it is mentioned by implication in references to reserves of $249 million, or thereabouts. That is the money that they have made.
Out of the customers?
I suppose.
They also mention assets of $500 million, or thereabouts. Have they made that too?
Not exactly. That is the money they use to make money.
I see. And they keep it in a safe somewhere?
Not at all. They lend it to customers.
Then they haven't got it.
No.
Then how is it assets?
They maintain that it would be if they got it back.
But they must have some money in a safe somewhere.
Yes, usually 500 million or thereabouts. This is called liabilities.
But if they've got it, how can they be liable for it?
Because it isn't theirs.
Then why do they have it?
It has been lent to them by customers.
You mean customers lend banks money?
In effect, they put money into their accounts, so it's really lent to the banks.
And what do the banks do with it?
Lend it to other customers.
But you said that money they lent to other people's was assets.
Yes.
Then assets and liabilities must be the same thing?
You really can't say that.
But you just said it. If I put $100 into my account, the bank is liable to have to pay it back. So it's liabilities. But they go and lend it to someone else, and he's liable to have to pay it back. So it's assets. It's the same $100, isn't it?
Yes, but
then it cancels out. It means, doesn't it? The banks haven't really any money at all.
Theoretically.
Never mind theoretically. And if they haven't any money, where do they get their reserves of $249 million or thereabouts?
I told you, that is the money they have made.
How?
Well, when they lend your $100 to someone, they charge him interest.
How much?
It depends on the bank rate, say 5.5%. That's the profit.
Why isn't it my profit? Isn't it my money?
It's the theory of banking practice that
when I lend them my $100, why don't I charge them interest?
You do.
You don't say. How much?
It depends on the bank rate, say 0.5%.
Grasping of me, rather.
But that's only if you're not going to draw the money out again.
But of course I'm going to draw it out again. If I hadn't wanted to draw it out, I could have buried it in the garden, couldn't I?
They wouldn't like you to draw it out again.
Why not? If I keep it there, you say it's a liability. Wouldn't they be glad if I reduced their liabilities by removing it?
No, because if you remove it, they can't lend it to anyone else.
But if I wanted to remove it, they'd have to let me.
Certainly.
But suppose they've already lent it to another customer.
Then they'll let you have someone else's money.
But suppose he wants his too, and they've let me have it.
You're being purposefully obtuse.
I think I'm being quite acute. What if everyone wanted their money at once?
It's the theory of banking practice that they never would.
So what banks bank on is not having to meet their commitments.
I wouldn't say that.
Naturally. Well, if there's nothing else you can tell me, then...
Quite so. Now you can go off and open a banking account.
Just one last question.
Of course.
Wouldn't I do better to go off and open up a bank? Salutations, Seth Stackers and Ken. You're listening to A Boy Named Sue. That is Mr. Sue to you on the Bitcoin Made Simple podcast network. And that was fun. That was great. I'm very excited for the series. So welcome to the inaugural first of many episodes of the chapter review of The Creature from Jekyll Island. And of course, I have an accomplice with me today and hopefully throughout the rest of the series as it unfolds. But I'm being graced with the great presence of Uncle Jim.
What's happening?
Honest Hoddle.
Whatever you want to call me. Here's my
face reveal.
Fuck you guys. Here I am.
Here he is. Awesome. So yeah, this is going to be fun. We're going to learn some stuff.
Let's do it.
I like to think of this book as like the history of everything, because it's not just about the Federal Reserve. We get into world wars and new world order and a bunch of crazy shit just out of this world. But we're just going to take it slowly, you know, we're going to have a little foreplay. We're going to ease into it and we're just going to hit you with all of it. Before we hit you with anything, I do want to hit you that we are very blessed and graced by our sponsor, Shift Crypto. That is shiftcrypto.ch. And if you learn anything out of this chapter and the remaining chapters of this book, then you know or will soon know how important self-custody is, because not your keys, not your cheese. That's what we're all about. And if you enjoyed that little parable, comic strip, whatever that we just went through, then you know that they're out to fuck you. And when you got your Bitcoin on the exchange, it's not your Bitcoin. So if you want to change that and not be a moron and actually be your own bank and preserve your time and wealth and savings and all that good stuff, then go to shiftcrypto.ch and use the promo code Bitcoin Made Simple, all caps, no spaces. I don't think it's actually all caps, but if you want to be obnoxious and use all caps, please do so. But Bitcoin Made Simple, and you'll get 5% off on our boy Luke Mikic's favorite sleek, sexy, slender, whatever he goes gaga over. But it's a great hardware wallet, so pick it up and own your own keys. And that's pretty much it. We will revisit them throughout the episode, but let's just take this nice and slow. So if you're not familiar, Creature from Jekyll Island, I think originally published in 1994, G. Edward Griffith, I'm pretty sure it's Griffith, dude spent like literally decades writing this thing. And I think he actually started it as a book club in his local community. And it was just, there's been so many like different edits. Like a lot of books, I think started as essays and originally published in 1994. And then I think 10 years later in 2014, that's the one that we are going through. Mainly because it's the not unedited. What's the phrase?
Unabridged.
Yeah, unabridged. There we go. Thank you, Jim. And it's got a little nice special section about the 08 crisis in chapter 3, which I'm looking forward to. Yeah. But that's what we are going to walk through. And of course, it's about the history of the Federal Reserve and really a bunch of other stuff and the corruption of money and why fiat is cancer to the soul. And it's just central planners playing God with people's lives. But also, this is the Bitcoin Made Simple podcast network. And so ultimately, we are trying to draw everything back to this is why we Bitcoin. This is why some money is important. And so obviously, that's going to be the main narrative. But to kick things off, if I pull up my handy dandy Google Doc sheet, and we'll just get started on the essentials. But as I'm getting the stuff ready, Jim, how are you? How are you doing, man?
Doing good. Glad to be here, obviously. Love the topic. Love the topic. And then, you know, it's great. You know, we'll be able to tie it right into Bitcoin, obviously.
Awesome.
So, yeah, let's do the damn thing.
Dope. Is that, was that the train in the background?
Is that bad? Yeah.
That's great. That? No, it's fine. It's fine.
It didn't even give a toot-toot yet. But
a toot-toot. Yeah. Jim, what are you drinking?
This is a tequila añejo. Adictivo is the tequila. My father-in-law showed it to me. So it's pretty good.
Very nice.
Yeah.
You don't salt your rim?
No salt on this rim. No. No, thank you.
I would. Anyway, I'm not drinking. I'm being a sober boy today. All right. So let's just kick it off. So in the inspiration of Murray Rothbard in Anatomy of the State, he basically identifies what the state is not. And I think that's appropriate to do that with this book and what the Federal Reserve is not. So what the Federal Reserve is not is, one, it's not federal. There are no reserves, and the Federal Reserve banks are not even banks. And so the first section is basically covering the secret meeting on Jekyll Island in Georgia, at which the Federal Reserve was conceived. And the true intentions, I'm just going to, like, you know, face reveal, show you the junk right now up front and center, is that basically the secret meeting's true intentions was really the birth of a banking cartel to protect the members from competition. And it was just the strategy of how to convince Congress and the public that this cartel was not only not a cartel, it was an agency of the United States government, and that they are the ultimate protectors of the public. So just to summarize this whole chapter, we're going to go and cover how it was the basic plan of the Federal Reserve System was basically drafted at a secret meeting in 1910 of November at the private resort of J.P. Morgan on Jekyll Island, hence the name of the book. And those who attended, I think, made up conservatively a fourth of the world's wealth. But I don't even know what it might actually be, like maybe 90%, who the hell knows. And
that's conservative, yes.
Yes, yes, very much so. And so people who attended it made up the financial institutions of Wall Street and indirectly Europe. A lot of incestual negotiations and stuff there. And so the reason that it was secret was basically pretty simple, because if people found out that rival financial factions of the banking community had joined together, then the public would have just, you know, sniffed a skunk there and thought it was a possibility that these bankers were actually plotting an agreement in restraint of trade, which was, of course, exactly what the hell they were doing. And so they had five objectives here, and that was to stop the growing competition from the nation's newer banks. We'll get into that. Obtain a franchise to create money out of nothing for the purpose of lending, or for the purpose of giving the banks the VIG, with fiat money, to get control of the reserves of all the banks so that the more reckless ones would not be exposed to currency drains, which Uncle Jim here will very articulately explain, and prevent run on the banks. Ultimately, get us, the taxpayer plebs, to pick up the tab of the cartel's just reckless behavior with our money. And to, again, convince Congress that the purpose was to protect us, the public. And basically, these bankers had become partners with politicians in order to do that, and had structured it as a cartel and to just make it a central bank. But you can't use the B word in this bank, because Europe already did that. And so basically went to, again, euphemisms are very, very common in politics, or let's just call them nice white lies, if you will. And for the record, the Fed has failed to achieve its stated objectives, because those, of course, weren't their primary goals. Because as a cartel, in terms of the five objectives that I stated above, they have been an unqualified success. But again, you know, they said the quiet parts out loud through their actions. But as we will see, Nelson Aldrich kind of revealed just a year after 1913, when the Federal Reserve Act was in place, that, hey, yeah, we kind of like made this so the banks could be in charge of, or the central bank could be in charge of all the banks. But let's just get into it. So, Jim, if you want to kind of paint a picture of that fateful day, that fateful day, 1910.
Sure. Yeah. So basically, there were six guys, including Mr. Aldrich, that aborted a train in Boston and went about 1,000 miles south to Jekyll Island. They were not, you know, basically they were told, don't tell them anybody your names. They went by first names. That's it. Two of them actually chose the names Orville and his brother. Thank you. The Wright brother. Excuse me. I can't think of the other guy's name. Orville and holy shit. Anyway,
doesn't matter.
So they chose, they went as far as to do that. So they were disguising themselves basically. So nobody knew of this meeting. So it kind of tells you what lengths they actually went through to get, you know, to keep this a secret. So yeah, where am I at here, Phil?
They all kind of like did this like clandestine thing. And it was basically headed by Nelson Aldrich, who, yes, if I pull up the PDF here, he was just a prominent senator. And let me see here.
He was a Republican whip in the Senate. Yeah. He was chairman in the National Monetary Commission, worked for J.P. Morgan. I think he was also, he was related to Rockefeller too. So I think he was father-in-law to John Rockefeller. So
Junior.
Yeah. Thank you. Yeah, that's right. Yeah. So,
It's just like a prime example of how incestuous like finance, like, this is what you kind of see in global like domination, or like oligarchs coming in and they get so up top and create their own monopolies, and they have a lot of power and influence over politics. And so it's just really not surprising to see Aldrich and all the rest of these people basically able to pay off like the politicians. And it's just like this incestual oligarchic catastrophe that we so basically they all got into went under fake names under Nelson Aldrich's car. And the one of the porters, it is funny like reading in between the lines here, they all got in the car, but the guy that like let them in basically knew all of them by like first name. He's like, hey, by the way, the reporters are out here, they want to know what's going on. And I think Davidson basically took him outside and like gave him a little talk and came back, hey guys, he's not gonna say a fucking word. So I don't know if he paid him off or threatened him with some early Clinton inspired tactics or whatever. Yeah. But yeah, basically they knew what they were doing here, to establish their cartel.
Here, I'll run through just the attendees here real quick too. So we had Nelson Aldrich, right? He's Republican whip in the Senate. Okay, we went through him. Abraham Piatt Andrew, he's Assistant Secretary of the United States Treasury, grandnephew of Andrew L. Gray. We'll get to that later, actually. Frank A. Vanderlip, he was the president of the National City Bank of New York and the most powerful of the banks at that time. He was representing William Rockefeller and the International Investment Banking House of Kuhn, Loeb & Company. All right, then we have Henry P. Davidson, he's senior partner, J.P. Morgan. Charles D. Norton, president, J.P. Morgan First National Bank, New York. And then Benjamin Strong, head of J.P. Morgan's Bankers Trust Company, and then Mr. Paul M. Warburg, partner.
Daddy Warbucks.
Exactly. Yes. Who is representative of the Rothschild banking dynasty in England and France.
Dun, dun, dun.
Brother to Max, who is head of the Warburg Banking Consortium in Germany. So you obviously, this is a big intermingling of,
duck hunters. That's what they were doing.
I don't know what I want to call them. Yeah, duck hunters, right?
Yeah. And so, and Aldrich didn't even own a gun, let alone know how to shoot one.
That was the point I was going to make. Yep. You're right. Yeah. He borrowed it from his friend. Just, so it shows you the lengths they went through to, keep this a secret or disguise it, right?
Yeah. So this was a heavy concentration of all the world's wealth. And let's just kind of like get into that a little bit. So sure. There was actually a House Committee on Currency and Banking that sector within Congress, I guess. It was under the, they basically did an investigation on like, okay, who actually holds like all the wealth in the world? Maybe not the world, maybe I think it was just the US.
Well, where is it concentrated, right? And who,
yeah, you know, where is it concentrated? Yeah. So, and it was under the chairmanship of his name was Arsene Puyo of Louisiana. Yep. And he was actually like a spokesman of oil interests, ironically, and he tried to actually sabotage this committee, but I guess he was outnumbered by the people that were actually doing the investigating. So right. It's kind of funny.
Yep.
And so the committee found that the proof of the country's wealth had concentrated in, of course, a few of the leaders in finance, and it was rapidly, which meant the rapid growth of money and control was just in the hands of a few. So I did some bullet points here. Maybe you can just open this up a little bit, but I thought it was really important to just explain any plud that's trying to invest, they don't like directly own that investment. So kind of quoting from the book,
sure.
And this is a quote taken from the committee report that they released. Under our system of issuing and distributing corporate securities, one, the investing public does not buy directly from the corporation. The securities travel from the issuing house through middlemen to the investor. Only the great banks or bankers have had the power to underwrite or guarantee the sale of large-scale security issues. How is this done? Only they have direct access to the mainsprings of the concentrated resources made up of other people's money, which is in the banks and trust companies and insurance companies. Yep. So basically, we're stepping into stakeholder capitalism here. Right. Only the minority of stakeholders at the top wield the power and control of the machinery for creating markets and issuing and distributing corporate securities. And these are people that like run the railroads and have like built kind of like, you know, industry tycoons,
dynasties.
If you will.
Yeah.
And because they built all the shit that everybody relies on, they are the ones that can stick their hand into the pools of wealth.
Right. For their interests, for their any venture that they really want, honestly. Yep.
Yeah.
Yep. I was going through it, you know, a day ago or two, and just thinking about it and stuff. And it's like all this money's tied up and these guys can actually tap it, you know, these reservoirs. Right. And I kind of was like kind of relating it to your 401k or IRAs and shit, you know, like, yeah, you can take that money out whenever you want. Sure. You're going to have, you know, pay tax and then interest or penalty and interest on it. But like, so I kind of think it's like, because you're tying all that money up for a certain amount of time, you're going to get this benefit, whether it's going to be, you know, tax-free at the end or it's going to grow tax-free. Right. But like, what is that money doing while it's sitting there? Right. And I'm just like, are they tapping? Are they, they're obviously doing the same shit that's been going on for years. Right. And it's just kind of crazy. And I've just kind of tied that together. And then I'm like, is it actually worth it for me to put my money there, you know, and actually keep it there? And oh, because I'm, you know, whatever I'm investing is sure is going to make some money, but like, it's kind of crazy. I kind of tied that together and I'm like, they're fucking playing with our money and shit. You know what I'm saying? It's just so, yeah, it's
interesting. BlockFi.
It's fucked. But yeah.
Very much so.
So,
all right. And so I guess this now leads us to the section on the cartel. Where am I going out of order here? Concentration Welsh. The destination to Jekyll Island. You want to fill us in on some details here, Jim?
Yeah, let me see here. Yes, here we go. So yes, like I said earlier, 1,000-mile journey. It led them to Atlanta, then to Savannah, and then finally a small town in Brunswick. Brunswick, Georgia. Located on the Atlantic seaboard. This land was purchased by J.P. Morgan and several of his business associates, where they came like, you know, every fall and winter to hunt ducks, deer, and basically escape the rigors of the North. they came down here. The purpose of this meeting was not to hunt ducks, obviously. So the goal was, you know, to create a cartel. Arriving there, you know, the whole town, it's a small town of, I think maybe a 10, I can't remember, 10,000, probably less.
And, yeah, I think like two or some shit.
Yeah, I think it was way less than that. So obviously everybody's kind of like, what's going on? Who are these guys? You know, and I think it was the town, I don't know if it's the mayor or someone, you know, basically told all the reporters and everybody, you know, it's, you know, he's just bringing his friends down to shoot, you know, to go hunting and stuff this weekend. And nothing else was basically said. The reporters believed them. They, you know, went away. And then another interesting thing, all the maids and servants and stuff that were at the, at Jekyll Island, at the quarters or wherever they were staying, were switched out, you know, like they brought in a whole new crew just so they, you know, didn't know anybody, then nothing could be said. Like, you know, again, going, showing like the lengths they went through to keep this a secret.
I missed that detail. That's Sorry. So funny. They gutted yeah. out the people that, wow.
Yeah. Yeah.
New so. Maid, new chef, fucking everyone.
Everybody. Gone. Yeah, exactly. So.
Oh, that's great.
Yep.
And the story is confirmed. So like, you know, day by day, day, year by year, there are publications and leaks of actually what happened. And yep. the first one appeared in 1916
yep.
In Leslie Weekly, as written by a young financial reporter by the name of B.C. Forbes, who yes. later founded Forbes magazine.
Mm-hmm.
And it was, let me see, it was actually in critical like acclaim and praise of Paul Warburg himself, and it was very likely that Warburg let the story out during the conversations with the writer. And then anyway, I just want to read the opening paragraph here. I think it's important. Mm-hmm. So picture a party of the nation's greatest bankers stealing out of the New York on a private railroad car under the cover of darkness, stealthily heading hundreds of miles south, embarking on a mysterious launch, sneaking onto an island deserted by all but a few servants, there living a full week under such rigid secrecy that the names of not one of them was mentioned, lest the servants learn the identity and disclose to the world the strangest, most secret expedition in the history of American finance. I am not romancing. I'm giving to the world, for the first time, the real story of how the famous Aldrich Currency Report, the foundation of our new currency system, was written. So I don't know. Oh, it just gets all like fluffy and secrety and whatever shit. But ultimately, they went here to create a cartel. And this is where I'm going to step in, because I think this is very, very, very important to kind of just, you know, go through. So what is a cartel? It's a group of independent businessmen which join together to coordinate the production, pricing, and marketing of their members. And basically, it's the purpose to just kill out all the competition and then increase profitability via a shared monopoly over that particular industry. This one, obviously, banking. And so this forces everyone to pay higher prices for the goods and services, because you don't have a free market where there's innovation happening and you have a lot of different competitors, because cartel stomps out competition. And so here, that's exactly what the representatives at this meeting tried to accomplish. And so the representatives of the world's leading banking consortia, we went over this already, but just to again emphasize, we have Morgan, Rockefeller, Rothschild, Warburg, and Kuhn and Loeb. Mm-hmm. And I want to highlight, underscore, whatever this point, because my brain has been turned inside out learning about the Fed and the nuance of a people members in a cartel.
Yeah.
So they were often recognized as fierce competitors of one another. And to quote the book, there's little doubt that there was considerable distrust between them and skillful maneuvering for favored positions in any agreement.
Yep.
So yeah, they were able to basically get together as competitors.
Mm-hmm.
And I mean, they basically had one enemy. That was competition. That was us. That was the plebs.
Right. To protect,
that was the free market. But I just want to, and we'll come back to this later throughout the sure. book, and just tap into what we're seeing in the modern day of 2022 sure. and arguably June of last year, 2021, mm-hmm. where the cartel can break. They might think everything's hunky-dory and aligned with the same agenda, but at some point that can be stressed, because humans are going to human. And if their incentive changes, then they will steer course, because money talks at the end of the day. But regardless, for the purpose of this chapter in this entire book, they basically came together and they wanted to stamp out competition. So let's talk about that competition. In 1910, the number of banks in the U.S. more than doubled to over 20,000 in a decade, which is insane. Mm-hmm. And most of them were coming out from the South and the West, and this started to make the New York bankers piss their pants, and they were losing all their market share. So almost all the banks in the 1880s were national banks, and that meant that they were chartered by the federal government. And then generally, they were located in the big cities, naturally, and they were allowed to issue their own currency by law in the form of bank notes, paper money. Great. And even as early as 1896, though, the number of those non-national banks had grown to, numbers are important, people, 61%. And then they already held 54% of the country's total banking deposits. So the largest banks weren't actually holding the majority of the money that was in circulation. These non-chartered kind of grassroots banks were.
So private, right? Yeah. Well,
private banks. Okay, and by 1913, what the hell is going on?
This is your friendly reminder to rate, subscribe, review. They say the best things, they come in threes, like rate, subscribe, review. If you rate it 5 stars, we can raise the bar. Subscribe so you can stay in tune. And don't forget at the very end to leave a nice review. Something like, I love you, Sue. Rate, subscribe, review, please. Thank you.
Not your keys, not your coin. If you're in Bitcoin and you haven't heard this, you're hearing it now. The value proposition of Bitcoin is that you are your own bank. You take complete self-custody of this thing, and you don't need to trust anyone but yourself. As Uncle Ben says, with great power comes great responsibility, and I'm pretty sure that all you Bitcoiner dudes and ladies out there can put on your grown-up pants and take self-custody. Honestly, one of the best options is the Bitbox O2 by Shift Crypto, because it's just sleek and voluptuous and lovely, and it's user-friendly. And that's what we want out of Bitcoin. We want to be able to store Bitcoin, access it, use it in a way that a toddler can. And that's pretty much what you're getting from the Bitbox O2. You got your cold storage on a hardware device, and you can sleep soundly at night knowing that you're your own bank and no one else can come and steal your Bitcoin. And that's all possible with Ship Crypto's Bitbox O2. So if you want to put on your big boy and big girl pants and be a good Bitcoiner and actually own your money, as opposed to putting it on an exchange or a bank, let's just call them for what they are, a bank, where they're rehypothecating that Bitcoin. And again, this isn't your Bitcoin. If you put it on there, it's theirs. And so it's not your money they're losing, it's their money they're losing, because they're trying to use that Bitcoin to make more money, take the spread, the VIG, if you will. And honestly, they go tits up, because they're bad actors, and they don't care about you and your wealth, because when your Bitcoin's with them, it's no longer yours. So if you want to bypass all of that, go to shiftcrypto.ch and snag yourself a Bitbox O2. Use the promo code Bitcoin Made Simple, all caps, no spaces, for 5% off a Bitbox O2 from shiftcrypto.ch. Because self-custody is self-sovereignty. Get that Bitcoin in the right hands. Your hands.
Maybe you disconnected. And then
this is weird. I don't think I did. Yeah. With fuck it, we're doing it live.
Oh my god, special guest. He's like, yeah, I gotta say something. Yeah, you guys were wrong about something.
Oh shit. It's Corey.
Yeah. Hi, hello, Corey. Can't you see him?
Hi. Sorry about that.
Fucking kick me out, bro.
I did not mean to do that. So sorry I interrupted your flow.
Well, it's okay. Ladies and gentlemen, Corey Tusek, the
man. This is great.
The man behind the curtain of the Bitcoin Made Simple podcast network. Corey. Oh, wait, y'all met.
Yeah. We met down in Miami, but
going to Miami.
I don't even think I knew that the Zoom app was opening on my computer. Like, I think I must have had it open, and then I opened the computer. Like, I either closed it, and then I opened the computer, and then all of a sudden I'm like, why do I see Phil and Jim? And I'm like, oh my God, they're recording live, and somehow I'm in it.
Phil's like, fuck, what'd I do? I'm like, I don't know, I hear you. Like, we're going.
Well,
that's way to fuck it up for us, Corey.
Yeah, I'll let you guys go.
This is beautiful.
I'll just bounce. I hope it doesn't. If I leave, is it going to mess it up now?
No, maybe. Just don't leave.
Yeah, I'll just stay and go ahead. Keep talking. Yeah. I'll just listen. I'll turn my computer. Or I'll probably mute everything.
Yeah, your yellow shirt's very distracting.
Yeah.
Is that another Star Wars shirt? What is that?
No, this one's a hockey. The Pittsburgh Penguins.
Oh.
So, okay. You know, that not Star Wars today. I mean, usually I'm wearing a superhero or a Star Wars shirt. So,
yeah.
Anyways. All right. Sorry for crashing your episode. This is so funny. But
this is awesome.
Thank God I was closed.
Fuck it, we'll do it live.
Thank God I was closed. Hey, you didn't fucking know what was happening. Yeah.
I know. I just opened the computer. I mean, you know, it's I was just going to check an email before I decided to sign off for the day. But all right. Yeah. See you guys later.
Make sure you're on mute this time.
Oh, I'm muting it. Yeah, you will not pick up any conversation this time.
Yeah.
All right, see ya.
See ya, man.
All righty. Anyway, by 1913, when the Federal Reserve Act was passed, those numbers were 71% instead of 54%. So these non-charter banks held 71% of the nation's wealth by time after the Federal Reserve Act was passed. And the non-national banks, let me see here. Actually, no. I fucking redid that. I fucked it up.
Anyway. Corey. All right.
Anyway, God damn it, Corey. Just blame Corey. So so the majority of the ratio of like non-charter banks to charter banks, basically non-charter banks made up 71% of the market. And then they were now holding 57% of the deposits in the country.
Uh-oh.
And of course, New York banks weren't going to have this shit. And ultimately, this was a demonstration of the free market works, dude. Like, let it roll. Just let it fly. Yep. Because what you had here is you had competition, despite like the wildcat banking era where banks were going bust because they loaned up, as Jim's going to explain, but they just, you know, offered too many loans. They didn't have the reserves. And when banks do that and they fail, they send direct market signals to the public to tell people, oh, this bank fucked up. Let's not do what they did. And so you just have this blossoming of new banks and competition and increasing quality. Like, this is what Jeff Booth talks about in his book, The Price of Tomorrow. Because, I mean, yes, like innovation in technology, but banking is a technology. And so when you don't have these arbitrary regulations from the federal government telling you who can and who can't, I mean, they probably had some like guidelines, but you actually had this like renaissance of finance, and you had all these different banks trying to do what they could. And you just had these grassroots banks eat the lunch of the big cat New York bankers. And it's just really, really sad. Like, that's ultimately why we can't have nice things, because the state is threatened by our success and prosperity.
And then central banking though, too, as well. Like, I mean, you know, this was the Federal Reserve Bank that we're talking about now was the fourth one that was created in the United States. Right. So,
yeah.
So that's the other thing too. People, you know, you have to remember, just to make that point.
Yeah, I think we get into that in a later chapter, but okay, yes, maybe this was the first successful attempt/con.
Successful, right? Exactly.
Yep. But yeah, I mean, it's just sad to see that like the free market always wins, and deflation and an abundance of options were provided by the technological innovation from the free market that, you know, allowed it to happen. And so competition was also coming from a new trend in the finance industry, which was financing future growth out of profits, actual hard-earned capital that people held instead of debt or borrowing money that you didn't have and banking on that you were actually going to be a prosperous business and profitable. And so how did this all work out? So basically the outgrowth of just free market interest rates, essentially, because again, you have this experimentation of banking's going bust and then other banks forming and learning from those mistakes and having sounder reserve requirements. And so the rates were low enough to attract serious borrowers who were confident of the success of their business ventures and knew that they were going to be profitable. Yep. And because of that, they were profitable and had the ability to repay on their loans and service their debt. And it was also, there's also an issue that there were the rates were also high enough to discourage loans for frivolous ventures or right. You know, those of which that were of alternative sources to funding, like debt or instead of using one's own capital. And so this whole balance of debt and thrift was then a result of a limited money supply, which was to gold.
Limited money supply.
Exactly. That's so the banks could create loans in excess. Yes, it was excessive, but there was like a standard
that
they abided by, which was the gold standard, because sound money always wins.
Yep.
And then fast forward a little bit. So between 1900 and 1910, 70% of the funding for American corporate growth was actually generated internally. Like, imagine that. Imagine we didn't like fucking ship all of our jobs to China or whatever, and we were a self-sufficient nation. And so this just made the industry increasingly independent of the banks themselves. You know, it was kind of like BYOB.
Yep.
I mean, quite literally. I'm like, I'm very curious how many people actually, you know, kept their reserves at home. You know, it was like, maybe it was like the analog of like running your own node.
Sure. Yeah. I mean, you know, during that time, what do they hold? Yeah. Yeah. You would think, or you would go to a bank that they were private banks that in your local town or whatever that you knew that you had some sort of a relationship with, I'm sure, you know what I'm saying? Yeah. And then when these private banks or these smaller banks or these wildcat banks, like we talked about, you know, start outgrowing or whatever, holding more of the money than the banks of New York and the Federal Reserve that are, excuse me, these bigger banks in New York are holding, they get pissed and they, you know, try to draw the money back to New York or whatever. So yeah, it's, you would think so kind of, you know, but because that's kind of how it was back then a little bit, but then, yeah, we'll get into it later, but yeah, go ahead.
Yeah. And like, just one last thing on this whole sound money is a contagion in of itself, because even the federal government was becoming thrifty. So they had a stockpile of gold, and that systematically led to them keep redeeming greenbacks from after the Civil War.
Yep.
And so, I mean, everybody was like on a sound money standard, and it was just threatening like the big cats and their market share. So it's just, I mean, life is better when the money's not being fucked with and when people, institutions are held accountable. So
if there needs to be an institution, which to a degree we'll see, but
to a degree but again, this whole like, I mean, think of living in this country where the government like had a balanced balance sheet. Like, that's just fucking wild.
When I first realized that this was Bitcoin, you know, and I'm going to tie it into Bitcoin real quick, but like Bitcoin was a, you know, ledger system that you couldn't fuck with. I'm like, holy shit. Right. Like that's what you're looking for. Cause what is money? And money is just a ledger system. That's it. Right. It's keeping record of transactions that's happened. And that's what the bank has taken over. You know, the bank is that intermediary, you know, that's doing that. So, but yeah, we'll talk about it.
So of course the, you know, your Rockefellers, your Warburgs, whatever, they wanted to stop this and intervene in this free market beauty. by, quote, tipping the balance of interest rates downward to favor debt over thrift. And the way they accomplished this was increasing the money supply, making it more elastic, and basically disconnect the banks from the gold standard and make money more plentiful. So basically lowering interest rates to incentivize bad behavior just so the banks can make profit or a vig off the customer by interest, because that's how banks survive. It's not right, by being banks, it's by giving out loans, not holding your money, spending your money and getting paid for that.
Well, yeah, they only have one source of revenue basically, or income. Not one, but you know, it's interest. It's earning primary interest. Yeah. It's primarily it's interest on, you know, loans that they loan out. So yeah.
Exactly. So Jim, take away from here. Tell us about the let me see here. What section are we in?
Currency. Currency drains.
No, there's one before currency drains.
The specter of bank failure.
Oh yes.
You can tie those two into each other though, too. Currency specter of bank failure. Because the specter of bank failure is basically specter of bank failure is basically on the bank. So anybody, you know, basically having everybody, you know, everybody knows what to run on the bank. It's basically going to demand their money that they have deposited at the same time. And the bank basically, you know, doesn't have it. Right. So that was the greatest threat, I guess you can say, not from rivals or private capital formation, but from the public at large. Right. So that was the biggest threat to these bankers, was the public all coming in demanding their money right now, right? Their deposited cash.
Well, I mean, that wasn't the biggest, because I like the book says the biggest was actually when the banks do that to each other, which is what currency drain was.
Right.
Where they borrow essentially from each other to loan up or give out like crazy loans at low interest rates. And they basically loan out all the reserves that they have, and they think, oh, well, I'll just go get more from bank B. So bank A borrows too much money and lends out too much money from bank B, and then bank C does the same thing from bank C, and then essentially they all go tits up and they're dry and they all have to default. But you can elaborately kind of open that up better than I just did.
What I meant by it was kind of the great, like, this is why they call it the specter of bank failure, you know, the greatest threat didn't come from like the rival or the private capital formation. That's what I'm saying. It's like, it was from the public at large. That's so like, that's the one thing, run on the bank from the people. Right. And then which also, but like the other thing, like you said, I think, I don't know, we can figure that out later, but like I'm saying, that was a big threat, obviously. Right. And then the currency drain also, which was kind of like the same thing, like I was explaining to you the other day, but like, it's like, so this was happening before the Federal Reserve, before the central bank, Federal Reserve bank system happened, like before they created this, you would have a currency drain, which was in between banks. Not, it's like a run on the bank, but not the people. It's so
the banks themselves and the institution, like it's the system going bankrupt.
It's, right. It's interbank. So it's Uptown Bank and Downtown Bank getting even with each other or settling with each other, because say I bank at Uptown Bank, Phil banks at Downtown Bank, right? Or whatever, or here, let's do this way. I bank at Uptown and I go to the store, whatever, I buy groceries. My grocer, he uses Downtown Bank, right? He takes my check and goes to Downtown Bank to cash it, right? But my check is from Uptown Bank. Okay. So between those banks, they need to settle up. Like, so my grocer's bank, Uptown Bank or whatever, he goes to Downtown Bank. Hey, you know, you owe us this money from like this. And if that bank, if the bank doesn't have it, then there, that's where the problem lies. So if let's say if both banks reserve ratios, if they were lending out, you know, like 95%, 92%, whatever it was, whatever it may be, say if it was 92%, it was both of them were lending out at 92% ratio or whatever. Then that's fine. In the long run, it would all even out in between banks, right? They would settle up, it'd be fine. But say one bank did, you know, was lending on 98% and the other was 92%, that's where there was a problem. The other bank, Uptown, couldn't pay Downtown, or vice versa, whatever it may be. And so that was another way a currency drain could have, or that was a currency drain in another way, another threat to these banks at the time before the Federal Reserve Bank was created. And we can get into what the Federal Reserve, you know, bank wanted to do to prevent that kind of thing. And they thought it was, well, we'll get into it. Yeah.
Yeah. But so, I mean, this was like the biggest threat that the people in the, let's just call it cabal, the people in the cabal that like met up, this was the biggest threat to them, because in 1910, the year that they met, that was the most common cause of bank failure.
And that was
during bankruptcy.
Right. That was the most common reason for banks that they created bank or declared bankruptcy in 1910, I believe, was currency drains. Yes. Now to run on the bank, because if you think about it, most people were not demanding. There really, I don't know if there really was, you know, a run. It would be more common for one bank to be loaning out at a higher or having less reserves. Be more common to have, for a bank to have less reserves, and then another, and then having, you know, that difference, and then having a currency drain, than opposed to a bank run, I guess. So it they tried to mitigate that risk, I guess, as we'll see. But you know, the more reckless banks, they wanted to loan up, right? And what that essentially does is you're pushing down your reserves. You're pushing down your reserve ratios as you're loaning up. So,
yeah,
think about that.
I'm trying to find where it talks about 10 to 1 just so we can make a 10 to 1 ratio joke.
Oh, yeah. Come on. What do you mean? You got this. 10 to 1. That's what they're loaning up, bro. That's what it's.
Yeah.
We didn't just get that from nowhere.
We didn't. Inside joke that people are just going to, if they don't know, if you know, you know, if you don't, you know, have fun staying poor. But basically, yeah, we have here that the, basically the way to prevent that from happening was, again, to create this cartel where you get rid of private capital and it all becomes public, to where the Federal Reserve has access to the reservoir of wealth by having a network of banks, and they basically all run on the same same protocol, where they all are following the same federal funds rate, where the interest rate is going to be this. You don't have this failure between banks where these other ones are successful. If we all fall, we all fall together, essentially.
Yep.
And then that's when daddy government can come in and nationalize.
We all walk the same distance from the line, basically, from the edge. That's how it was, right? Before that, it wasn't. That's how, like we said, had those currency drains. Yeah.
Yeah. Which was fine, because
it's the demand by money from other banks, right? That's what the currency drain was. And they wanted to prevent that, like, because everybody wasn't walking the same distance from the line at that time, right?
Yeah.
Yeah. So,
and by everybody being on the same standard, people could actually blame, a bunch of other things and not the banks themselves. So let me see, where is it here?
Well, you could shift the blame to the public, is the thing. That was the goal.
Yeah. Yeah. So whether it be trade deficits or.
Right.
Where'd it go? They were talking about that. You know, fuck it, we do it live. Where am I going next? So yeah, I mean, let's just like jump ahead to the banker's utopia, their objectives here. So they need to figure out how to stop the growing influence of small rival banks and to ensure that the control of the nation's financial resources will remain in the hands of those present. How were they going to make the money supply more elastic in order to reverse the trend of private capital formation and to recapture the industrial loan market?
Yes.
How to pool the meager reserves of the nation's banks into one large reserve, so all the banks will be motivated to follow the same loan to deposit ratios or protocol. And then that would protect at least some of them from currency drains and bank runs. And then lastly, this should lead eventually to the collapse of the whole banking system, then shift the losses again from the owners to the owners of the banks to the taxpayers. So we pick up the bill and we get the
Exactly.
We get the blame, but ironically, they say like they're the protectors of the public for having this set up.
Yeah, right.
So what the fuck? Yep. So, Jim, take it from here.
Yeah. Where am I at here?
So we kind of covered, I was at the cartel adopts a name, but I mean, that's just like more minutia details. So let's talk about Daddy Warbucks.
Yeah, let's see. The real Daddy Warbucks, Paul Moritz Warburg. Yes. Okay. What do you want to say? Like everybody knows the Little Orphan Annie, right? The comic strip. That's basically, you know, who Mr. Warburg was, or who the, what that was basically. Daddy Warbucks was, or Annie was, created after a guy that could have so much wealth, right, that he could basically use that wealth to create good, but you know, at the same time, he's, you know, running a huge cartel. And so I mean, it's just kind of funny. He became, you know, like became well known on Wall Street, is an advocate of central banks, but then, you know, then it's just with all this wealth, you create so much, you try to create good things, but then behind the scenes, it's like, holy shit, you know, what the hell's going on here? They're running a cartel. But yeah, so I mean, I don't know what else you want me to say about
it. I mean, it's just, I think this is important because it's again like the corruption of, you know, big money.
Well, it's a facade. I honestly,
no, yeah, yeah.
You know what I'm saying?
It's using your influence to just take control of the narrative of your perception to the public.
Right.
You know, similar to like Milo Yiannopoulos called like Trump his daddy or whatever sort of thing. And so like we got like Daddy Warbucks. He's here to like save us and knows how to, you know, best run.
Our orphanage. He helps all these people. Right. Exactly.
Yeah, yeah. Yeah. So we're like, we, the people are like the Little Orphan Annie, and Daddy Warbucks, he knows how to like run the books, knows what's in our best interest. And so it's this, it creates this myth and like manifests this lie into reality. And so if we jump to the section myth accepted as history here, yeah. I mean, the accepted version, version of history is that the Fed was created to stabilize the economy, again, protectors of the public.
Mm-hmm.
And of course that's not true like at all. And so we can see through just the failures of, I mean, it's like they're just completely incompetent because it's been through us. Let me just read off this. So the Fed's been with us, helping us and protecting the public through all the crashes of 1921. Since its inception, it's been through 1921, 1929, the Great Depression, 1939 recession, recessions of 53, 57, 69, 75, and the 1981 stock market Black Monday in 87. And we have since then seen 1,000% inflation, which right now is probably like way over that because that was reported in 1994. And God knows where the fuck we are now, but it's destroyed basically probably 99% of people's wealth, like with inflation, and has only exacerbated the wealth gap.
Yeah.
And so I mean, let's
it has consequences, you know?
Yeah.
That's what happens. Obviously. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. So the point I want to touch on that the book does is by 1990, an annual income of $10,000 was required to buy what took only $1,000 in 1914.
Right. Yeah.
So.
Yeah.
Yep. Yeah. Actions have consequences. Actions
have consequences. Yeah. See. That's what, you know, corporate debt, everything, interest rates. I mean, inflation. It's all because of this, and it's funny how, you know, like how you think back. It's like, how do they keep it like this long? It's just like the narrative has to be played out so well, and they have these tools in their bag that they can use, that it's just, it's crazy thinking about it, how, you know, they've kept the scam running.
Yeah. And the book mentions that this is like both political parties, like the Fed has just stayed there present and manipulating everything, no matter who is in charge, at least on the surface. But at the end of the day, it's about the money, stupid. Mm-hmm. And so let's get into, the first reason to abolish the system. So you want to take that?
Go ahead. I lost my spot.
Oh, I mean, the first reason to abolish it is that its so-called objectives were lies. Like, they were bald-faced lies. And it was just to create a cartel, and it wasn't to actually stabilize economic prosperity. Ta-da.
Go ahead. Sorry.
Are you there?
I'm lost.
No, I mean, that's pretty much it.
Yeah, I was going to say. Well, I mean, you know, it's the first chapter. It's like hard to like, you know.
Yeah. I mean, we could get into the details here. Going. But I mean, this book is kind of redundant, but for all the right reasons.
Right. I think the examples and stuff in it are great. Like when she gets in the second chapter here and third chapter, you know, some of them like where they compare, you know, like, you know, being at a football game or whatever and that shit, but I'm not going to get into it, but you know, and how they compare the Federal Reserve System to going to a football game and what's happening. It's like, if you're watching it, you didn't really know the rules and stuff, what was going on. And
yeah, so we'll the whole stealing your hubcap thing. It's great.
Yes, yes.
Exactly. I mean, it's not great. It's terrible, but.
Right. But that's what I'm saying. Like you said, yeah. It's redundant, to a degree, but it's a good story, I guess, if you will.
Yeah. So let's try to tie this up to Bitcoin a little bit if we can.
What? Then we're talking about the Federal Reserve. What the fuck? So I mean,
I don't know, man. Like
pretty simple. Like yeah. But it's not, is it? It's simple, but it's not. The Federal Reserve is a central banking cartel, whatever you want to call it, authority, mediary that people use, that everybody needs banking or has used banking for what reason? To hold, well, first started with gold, they needed to hold gold, things like that. And then trust comes into that, right? But why was it created in the first place, right? Why were these Federal Reserves created in the first place? Well, because we
said, by the way, it's 420.
Oh, what do you want me to do?
I just want to share that.
Thanks, Will. Thanks.
Yeah, you're welcome.
Go ahead.
No, you were gonna go.
I forgot now.
Trust.
Right. But also too though, it was to protect their best interests, right? To prevent competition. Like they wanted to hold their money, they wanted to remain dominant in their field or just in chances in the markets, in the railroad industry, in, you know, agriculture, shit like that, right? So how do you do that? You drown out competition by creating such a cartel like this. But like this also gets into the, you know, you have to talk about the creation of money and how that all happens too. Like, so this goes way back too, like into how, you know, all this, do I need a bank? What do I need a bank for? But like, what is the money? That's the thing. What money am I using? What is the medium of exchange at the time? And the state comes back too. It's just a lot of different things, right? So now when Bitcoin comes in, we can get rid of all that shit, basically, right? We don't need them to keep the ledger, right? I don't need the bank to keep an account of my transactions, and I don't need them to hold it, because why am I having the bank hold my money in the first place? Because like, well, it used to be because I could put it in there for a savings account and earn interest. But why am I earning interest? That's what people understand either too. Like, why am I earning interest on the money that I deposited into a savings account at the bank? Well, because they're saying, because you're going to go with the risk of you're lending us your money, we're going to take that and lend it out. So because we're going to lend it out and you're going to undergo that sort of risk, like we'll give you like certain percentage. Like, and it used to be okay, but now it's shit, right? So it's just like, just, I don't know where I was going with that, but basically you needed it for protection, right? Or something, or some, you know, if I had a lot of money, like it was either I wanted to make some interest on it, sure, at the bank, or I got a lot of it, I can't put it under my bed or whatever, someone's going to, you know, take it or something, right? It's just like you always put your money in the bank. But like with this, with Bitcoin, you do have some sort of, I mean, you are your own bank. So like you need to like actually be conscious and have somewhat of a good security and OPSEC around it, obviously, right? But that's the best part about it. You don't have to deal with any other third party that's going to fuck you, which has been, that's been happening forever. It's an amazing thing. I mean, but we never really had this opportunity before either. And that's the other thing. It's like, what do you do? What do you do if we're on a hard money standard and it's like, and what's the issue? I can't throw my money across the world. Like I can't throw my gold across the world or whatever. I can't, or something like that. We have to go through an intermediary or, if you want to talk about like the SWIFT system and shit like that, like that's another fucking joke, like in story and just another, and it's just layers and layers upon banking and institute that your money has to go through just because you want to send a fucking wire somewhere. So I don't know. I'm rambling now, but
no, like all great good points. And I think they'll like bring them back to like the notion of a cabal of really influential people in finance. That can't happen with Bitcoin. I mean, arguably it could. I mean, you can have Coinbase try to influence some developers, but we saw that backfire with the fork wars in 2017.
Yeah, because,
this is kind of getting into like a more, I guess, like psychological, philosophical like area here, but you just have like these toxic Bitcoin maximalists who are like, no, this is what our fucking money is, and that's how it's going to be. And my node is validating that this Bitcoin is going to be my Bitcoin for these reasons, because code. And, you can't do that like with the financial system as we know it.
No. You can't check their system, right? You can't see. I mean, yeah, you can. You're gonna have to wait, but like, you don't know what's going on back there. And like, yeah, exactly. That's the beauty. That's the beauty about it. It's your money, and you get to choose what happens with it going forward. Obviously, through different like BIPs and consensus and everything like that. And then you get to choose how you protect it too, like your level of protection and security. Like that's the best part about it. It's like, yeah, you can. Yeah, it's up to you.
Yeah. It's up to you.
It is up to you.
Shut up, Bill.
But yeah.
All right. Well, cool. I think I neglected my duties of doing 3 ad reads for shiftcrypto.ch, but here's a second one, and maybe I'll do a extra one, third one towards the end. We pretty much approached the end of this episode, but yeah, if you aren't a little scared, petrified after listening to us do this chapter review of chapter one of The Creature from Jekyll Island and understand that your money is something to be cherished and it is absolutely yours, then get your Bitcoin off of goddamn exchange, dude.
Yeah.
And put it in a cold storage hardware wallet, shiftcrypto.ch, get 5% off the Bitbox 02, and it'll help us out in the show out as well. Jim, is there anything you think that we missed at all? I don't think so. Again, I feel like this chapter was kind of like redundant, but it was like a good introductory.
It's kind of an overview, quick overview, introduction to them going to Jekyll Island and what it was and shit, I guess. So yeah, I mean, the next chapters that we get into are going to be pretty juicy and what I'm looking forward to, obviously. But yeah, this was good, I think, until I go back and listen to it again and see,
Yeah, everybody's own worst critic. But I would advise people to pick up the PDF like online of this book for free and just kind of like read some of the cliff notes and see the pictures of what these psychopaths look like.
They have a summary at the the beginning and the end of each chapter or whatever it is, like you read those. I mean, you don't have to go through every chapter and shit. It's great. You can just skim it.
You don't even have to list us fucking sound like assholes and try to
I'm sure nobody is. I wouldn't be. But yeah.
Yeah.
But no, this is cool. I'm excited. I'm gonna do better next time. I'm gonna lay it out real good.
Lay it out real.
But this was like you said, a little redundant, kind of an overview of the whole thing. But it's interesting. Yeah, when I first read this book, I was like, "What the fuck?" So it's highly recommend reading it, or just browsing it, or just flipping through the pages and everything. It's definitely eye opening.
Yeah, and I mean, it's because I'm a firm believer that markets are based on trust, and I mean, this unfortunately is what happens when you have that corrosion and corruption of that trust, when you're able to just have people benefit from stakeholder capitalism, like we see in Ethereum and other shit coins. And it's just able to spiral out of control because the money is easily corruptible. Yep. But again, it all comes back to that very thing.
Like, oh, and incentives. Like, what are the incentives of that person and that person that, you know, who is around all of that money or has access to all of that? And what they do then, what is in their best interest? Well, obviously it's to fucking keep all this money, right? And we're going to try to keep all this money and do our best to protect it. Federal Reserve.
Yeah.
Yeah. So good shit.
It just saddens me to see that, like, even a free market that did have all these like banks had optionality and people trusted one bank over the other. And still, like, it all comes back like to the money. And because there wasn't one thing that forced consensus of like, okay, we can't make any more of this, then you just had all those free market options completely wiped out. And so what excites me is that on the Bitcoin standard, because if we're being honest, we're going to have custodial solutions. And we don't even need to get into like how not every single person on the planet is going to own their own UTXOs. Sure. We're all going to be using second layer technology some way or another to, you know, send currency to each other. And I guess I'm opening up a can of worms here, but I guess if the supply of money is kind of like fixed, then somebody owns the UTXOs. So I guess it kind of brings back that element of trust and using second layer currency based on gold, like in the Wildcat banking era that we kind of briefly brushed over. So I guess the question becomes how solid or how efficient, how well does Bitcoin actually keep people liable, keep banking institutions, financial institutions liable and preventing from boom and bust to happen. But so, and to just edit that, or I guess append on it, it's still healthy if we have boom and bust that happen like that. Because again, it will just send back the signal like, hey, you know, let's not do what this institution did and collapse like it did. Because now we're on Bitcoin and we are forced to abide by the strict supply of 21 million. So I guess I answered my own question, but like, what do you think about that?
Yeah. What did you just say? Okay. Are boom and bust good? How did boom and bust cycles happen? Where did they originate from? Right. Federal Reserve.
Well,
every 10 years, right?
Well, yeah, but you're going to have like boom and bust in general as markets. Like there will be bubbles, but those corrections will occur but they will happen faster. Like that is ultimately what happened. Out. Yeah. Sure. When those like the private capital based banks, like that is what happened.
Right. And like you're right. You'll fail then and you'll be out of existence. And then the person will go to the next bank or whatever. That's better. Right. Exactly. I agree. I mean, eventually, hopefully, something like that, you know, well, not eventually, like hopefully Bitcoin can grow to something like that, which I think it has the potential, but like, there's a long way to go. You have to understand that, like, you just can't like blindly be like, this is going to fucking change everything. Right.
Yeah.
It's a fucking tool that we can use that is unbelievable, that we've never had anything like this before. Right. And that's gives us the freedom to do whatever the fuck we want with our money. But you need to understand and go about protecting it and learning how to protect and how to take control over it. So shit like these exchanges or something or whatever doesn't take control of it, or your regulators and shit taking over the exchanges and stuff, which may very well happen and stuff like that. Like that's a huge focal point of, you know, any sort of regulator coming in and trying to take stop Bitcoin is the exchanges. You capture the exchange and, you know, you can do a lot of shit with that then, right? You can basically tag your Bitcoin and see who has what, and basically eliminating Bitcoin's, you know, obviously it's an open ledger system, but there is probably, you know, it's pseudonymous. So like, it's just, yeah, I don't know. It's, yeah. Rambling again, but we can go on for days.
Yeah. Well, yeah. Let's cap it there, but that's a nice, quick last minute plug transition for Shift Crypto. .ch, get a hardware wallet. Like, seriously.
Get hard. Yeah,
get hard. Get hard money. Get hard yourself. Get a hardware wallet. And the more Bitcoin off exchanges, the sooner we'll probably see Bitcoin Moon. And your whatever holdings you have will be very, very valuable. And then that might be the incentive developers and just industry needs to figure out and scale to fail and fail to scale. So we can figure out how to best ramp up this, you know, what this Bitcoinized world's going to look like, I guess. Yeah. But yeah, this is great. I'm looking forward to going through this series. And I hope y'all enjoyed this very much as well. If we rambled and went on tangents, then you're just going to have to deal with it. Like I said, fuck it. We're doing live. We're doing it live. We're going to have Corey Tusek pop in on accident at times. And we're just...
That was good. I like that. Yeah,
I did too. It's a nice little intermission break.
Mm-hmm.
But yeah. Cool. So you've been listening to a boy named Sue. That is Mr. Sue to you, a.k.a. Phil Gibson. You can find me at Mr. Sue, M-R-P-S-E-U on Twitter. And Uncle Jim, where can people find you?
Twitter. That's it.
Yeah.
That's it. I mean, yeah.
The Honest Node.
Right? Honest HODL, I think, is my...
Honest.
Yeah. Honest HODL, H-O-N-E-S-T-H-O-D-L. Yeah.
Cool.
So
that's where we met, and that's where we frequent. That is, you'll hear us sound like assholes on Twitter Spaces as well. And follow the show, subscribe if you like it, and say the quiet parts out loud with us, because that's what I think this whole network is about. And just going through this book and the history of everything is doing that exactly. Saying the quiet parts out loud. You're not going to learn the shit in school. And
word.
And until next time, peace out, sayonara, adios. And as always, as I say at the end of this podcast, own your failure, because God knows our so-called leaders do not.
Toodles. Road to